The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect. I'm Stephen Scott, your host this hour. And yes, lots to get through on the programme this week. This is the programme for you if you're blind or partially sighted and you have something to say about sight loss, be it good, bad, or ugly, or a combination of all three. This is the place to do that. You can tell us what you think of the show as well. We'll give you all the details on that coming up here on The Weekly Connect. First, though, let me talk you through what's coming up on the show. Our big story this week is all about that landmark ruling in Northern Ireland, where blind woman Joanna Toner won a major legal challenge over the height of curbs in a multi-million pound regeneration scheme in her hometown of Lisburn. Also, if you're thinking about getting into employment, you might want to listen to Chris Dewar's story. He got into employment thanks to an RNIB Scotland scheme, and he has some words of advice for you if you're thinking about getting into the jobs market. And we head to Wales to find out about our Society of the Week. This week it is Sight Cymru, which began life back in 1865. That's all coming up.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
But first, we ended the show last week telling you about this, and I just thought we should start again by reminding you. If you are able to listen to the show on Freeview or online through the podcast, that's fantastic. But if you know someone who could benefit from the show who doesn't have access to either of those, then you might want to know that you can now listen to the show on your mobile or landline phone just by calling a phone number. Really simple. No longer do you need an internet connection or a Freeview TV to listen. All you've got to do is call the new RNIB info line. That's the RNIB info line, which is now available. And the number is 0203 4321 488. And when you dial it, you just hit option 3. Standard call rates apply. Mobile rates may vary. That number again is 0203 4321 488. And once you get through, hit option 3. And you can find out more on the RNIB website about all of that, rnib.org.uk, about the info line. Choose option 3 to listen to The Weekly Connect. Now, a blind woman has won a landmark legal challenge over the height of curbs in a multi-million pound regeneration scheme in Lisburn in Northern Ireland. Joanna Toner secured a ruling that the council overseeing the city centre project breached its legal duty to ensure equality for disabled people. She said the lower curbs were dangerous, as she could not tell where the pavement ended and the road began. Joanna is with me now. Hi, Joanna.
Hello.
Well, first of all, thank you for coming on to The Weekly Connect. Really appreciate you doing that to talk about this story, which I guess has been quite a lot of your time has been taken by this particular event over the past few months.
Yes, even over the past few years. It's been at least 2.5 years since I first sought legal advice, and a good couple of years before that, that the whole redevelopment programme was introduced. So it's been a long process.
So go back to the very beginning of this. For those who haven't been following this case, tell us a bit about how this all came about.
Well, several years ago, when the Lisbon in Focus project was running in Lisbon, which is, it was a lottery funded project with the RNIB and guide dogs and the local council all trying to do their best for the people in the area. They were around, so we had some support from them. And we learnt that the council were planning a big redevelopment scheme for the whole of the city centre. And we obviously wanted to be involved with that to make sure that they were going to consider our needs and that it was going to be an environment that we could all get the best out of.
So that was the beginnings of it. You at that point were just learning about this process.
Yeah, pretty much. We were, you know, as naive as the next person about what would and wouldn't work when we first came into contact with all of this. But we've learned a lot since.
But of course, you had heard of shared space schemes going on in other parts of the UK, hadn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that was the key word we were looking for, was shared space scheme. And that wasn't mentioned at all. And so yes, at first we thought, hey, this is going to be great. It's going to be something that brings things, you know, more entertainment to the town centre, maybe a bit more business, maybe improve the nightlife. You know, so we were very enthusiastic at the start when we went along to the initial public consultation meeting to find out more about it.
And what happened then?
That is up for debate, sort of. We went along and the architect did a presentation on how the area was going to look and what he was going to do. And I remember saying to him, this is all fantastic, this is great, you know, but as long as it's not going to be a shared space, as long as there's going to be curbs. And his response to that was, yes, there would be curbs. And that was really all we knew at the time. At the time, we presumed a curb was a curb. But, you know, little did we know how complicated the whole thing was going to get. And a few months later, that was when we found out exactly how high the curb was going to be. And at that point, alarm bells started ringing because obviously we had started to do a bit of research into this. And that was at the point when we discovered that the curbs were going to be only 30 millimetres and that the recommended height or the recommended minimum height that could be detected that was shown in the research by guide dogs, and that was set at 60 millimetres.
So it was a shared space by another name, essentially.
Pretty much. And what it's actually turned out to be is some areas have these 30 millimeter curbs and some areas have no curbs at all. So essentially speaking, they are, you know, it's a shared space.
And, you know, at that point, I guess you probably thought to yourself, well, we have to do something about this. And I guess having the conversations with the planning teams and with people who were involved in making the decisions, what were you facing, a brick wall in that one? Were you just not getting any response from them positively or otherwise?
A bit of everything, really. I mean, we had lots of meetings with various different people, with people from the planning committee, with the members of the council, with the architect, with our local MP. You know, we met with everybody to discuss the issues, the implications. We even went out for a walk with the local MP to demonstrate in an area that already had a flat curb, you know, how dangerous it was to accidentally wander out into the street. So we made our points as clearly and as often as we possibly could. And that went on for, I'd say, at least 18 months of doing that. We really didn't get anywhere. They just kept on deciding over and over again that they were going to continue with the recommendations from the architect and just carry on with the original plans that they had.
So what was the tipping point for you? What made you decide it was time to take this to court?
Well, it was the final meeting, I think, that the council had, and they were... It was literally, that was our last attempt at talking to them. And they went back to the committee again, and the committee just recommended that they carry on, you know, as is. And at that point, I just literally thought, what are we going to do? There is nothing left we can do other than seek some legal advice. A few of us went to a local solicitor's. It just so happened to be one that a taxi driver had actually recommended, because apparently a lot of people in the area had been putting in complaints about the scheme, you know, how it was being implicated, you know, that this, because they'd already started doing some work at this point, you know, and it was causing a lot of havoc with local businesses. So I just thought, hey, oh, well, why not? Let's go give this guy a shout and see what he has to say. And that was really the start of an incredibly long and complicated process that, I'm pleased that I got involved with, and I'm obviously pleased with the result, but I think I would hesitate before doing it again.
Yeah, that's the difficulty, isn't it? It's all very well saying, let's go and do this, but the process is quite difficult. You obviously had support as well from both Guide Dogs Northern Ireland and RNIB in Northern Ireland as well. What support did they offer you?
To be honest, at the start, it was a little hesitant. I think they've never been involved with anything like this before and didn't really know. They knew about as much as I did as to what to do and how to approach this. So at the start, I felt a little unsupported. I mean, I had various, you know, particular individuals who were very keen and, you know, very helpful. But as the months went on, R&IB and Guide Dogs became more involved, and they came along to the various different course appearances that we had, and their support just grew from there, really. And you know, at the end of it, from last Friday, I must say I'm very pleased with the support that both of them gave me.
So getting that support was important, and obviously then I guess locally you'd get a lot of support from people. And it's not just blind people, is it? I mean, you know, there are mums with prams, and there are elderly people who want to use their high streets and their local towns that I guess would be against a lot of these proposed changes.
They would be, but I think one of the biggest problems was that people didn't actually understand what I was arguing for and what exactly it is that we needed. And, you know, a lot of people, after seeing the first lot of media coverage we had a year or so ago, you know, would approach me and say, look, what's this all about? Why, what's your problem, basically? And I would get to explain it to some people. And the majority of people went, yeah, actually, that's utterly ridiculous. Why are they doing that? You would obviously get the odd one who still didn't agree with you, but you always do, don't you? But yes, I think in general, people were very supportive once they actually understood what the issue was. I think actually getting that across was quite difficult.
That's interesting, because you would think a lot of people would, you know, especially in local towns, you know, people who live locally, you know, would have an interest in their local area. But do you think it's just that they didn't understand where you were coming from specifically, and actually that this would have an impact on a whole wide range of people?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just a lack of understanding, really. And
is that all classic, isn't it? It's not a problem until it happens to you.
Pretty much, yeah. And I think there was a lot of other issues with the work that was going on. It was causing a lot of small businesses to actually lose trade, and some of them did go out of business, which was absolutely awful. I don't think the whole planning of how they carried out this work was considered especially well. And we did have a lot of issues when the work was being done, you know, with the safety. You know, with not putting barriers up properly, with the people actually working on the roads, not understanding the kind of help that we would need to get around them. So there were a lot of issues that we had to constantly battle with. And I think that a lot of people were initially on the side of the traders and just saying, look, get it over and done with, just get it finished, and weren't really thinking of the actual consequences of what this area would be like when it's finished. I think most people just assume that it's going to be okay, that, you know, the council, the architects, these are the people who are supposed to know what's best and they're supposed to do their jobs properly. And they just presume that whatever they come up with will actually work. And unfortunately, that's not the case these days.
I mean, for a lot of blind people who've had the experience of a shared space scheme, we get it. We understand the difficulties. But for those who either don't live in shared space scheme areas, or, you know, other people who just don't understand the complication, like you say, people who come up to you and said, what is this all about? What are the issues, Joanna? Why are these schemes so difficult and so, in some cases, dangerous for blind and partially sighted people?
Well, it's really quite simple, I suppose, because if you imagine that you're walking along a street and you have a road on your right-hand side and you have the building line on your left-hand side, in an ordinary street environment, between you and that road, there would be a curb that you can pick up by, you know, feeling it with your long cane. And that means that you can, you know, just readjust your position a bit and make sure you're just that little bit further away from the traffic. It also means that if you're trying to find a crossing and you go towards the road too soon, you're not going to accidentally walk out onto the road, and you know you're going to be able to keep walking along until you find that crossing. But if that curb's not there, you don't have that guide, you don't have that security between you and the traffic. Which, you know, on that straight stretch of road that I'm describing might sound quite easy. Some people say, well, can't you just walk in a straight line? But we all know it's not a case of that. There's street furniture to go around. There's people that get in your way. You can very easily get knocked off your straight line. And of course, then when you're in a situation where, you know, the road isn't straight and you've got corners and you've got turns and bends and hills and, you know, nothing's in a straight line for the majority of people, that's when a lot of the difficulties come in. Because if you're trying to get yourself around that corner onto a safe stretch of road again, or say a safe stretch of footpath again, you could very easily miss that corner. And that's the doorbell going off right in the middle of everything.
That's all right. I can pick up from a point, actually. Do you want to get that? And I can pick
No, it's Barry's getting it.
All right. If you could just take it from you. So how do I stop that? That was just 3, 2, 1.
So if you're trying to go around that corner to find yourself onto a safe stretch of footpath again, not having a curb there to keep yourself safe obviously means that you can walk into the road. And if you're trying to find the edge of the pavement and there is no crossing point marked with the tactile blistered cross paving that we've all seen, you can easily just walk straight out into the road. And that's something that I've done quite a lot of the time, especially when the traffic's a little bit on the quieter side. You know, I'm trying to find the crossing point and I miss it completely. And before I know it, I'm on the far side of the road. And that's awful. It could be really quite nerve-wracking to discover you're somewhere where you didn't think you were going to be.
So there were really two things for you. First of all, it kicked in that you'd realised that although it wasn't being called a shared space, it kind of was based on the whole height of the curbs, which, as you say,
yeah,
that minimum,
might as well have been.
Yeah, that minimum requirement of 60 millimetres was actually going to be roughly around 30 millimetres, which is mm-hmm. very difficult to detect with a white cane. And then, of course, there's issues with guide dogs and all of that. And then there was the second point that really was the most important thing, that you just weren't consulted at all in a meaningful and understandable way that could allow you to feed back appropriately, I guess.
Yeah, that was the point that we won the case on, was that any local authorities, they're supposed to do an equality impact assessment, which means that they assess how whatever decision they're going to make, whether it's something for, you know, redesigning a building, whether it's for the streetscape, they have to consider exactly how that is going to impact on any disabled group. And they were under the impression that they didn't need to do that, so they didn't.
So you won the case. Congratulations.
Yep. Thank you very much. Yes, at last.
What was that like? What was when the court made their decision? What were you thinking? Thinking, my goodness, I've managed to make this happen. It's all been worth it?
Actually, I was a little bit confused, to be honest with you. It was, we were expecting to only be in court for about 10, 15 minutes on Friday. But because of the nature of our visual impairment, the judge decided to summarise his report a lot more than he would have done for any other group. So we were in there for about an hour and a quarter. And of course, he's going through everything. And there were various points that we lost on. And he didn't he didn't agree with us on. But eventually we came to the points that we won on, which is the main things. So by that point, I was slightly confused as to what was going on and whether we had actually won or whether it was only a moral victory and nothing was actually going to change. That could have been one of the other outcomes. So yeah, we left the courtroom in a slightly bemused fashion.
What happened there?
We went into a separate room with our barristers, solicitors, with the people from Guide Dogs and RNIB's legal team and the media people, and we sat down and we had a good chat for about an hour as to exactly what had happened, what the implications were, and how I was going to put that across to the media in a clear and concise way, without sounding like a complete twit, but which hopefully I managed to do. But it was all quite an experience.
It sets quite a precedent, though, for shared space schemes around the country. And, you know, we're seeing this pop up all over the country. And not everyone is taking, going as far as you've gone in terms of taking local councils or planners to court over it. And, you know, that's a shame in some respects. But obviously it does come down to individual abilities to do that and the support that you might get to do it. But I think it does say quite a lot, because, you know, what we've seen now is that, you know, these regulations, that they must be followed, and they've not been followed appropriately, or they've been done so minimally, to the very, basic, level that they can do. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe something now that other planners will have to look at, because they'll maybe look at your court case and think, well, you know, we don't want another one of those, so maybe we better do it right in the next time. But are you hopeful on that, or do you think that it will just continue regardless?
I think it's going to take a lot of pushing and a lot of people to actually stand up and say no. I mean, they don't have to take it as far as I did, because we have now got this indication that, you know, the authorities have to do this equality impact assessment, which that will help a lot. And the other thing that I think was a great thing that came out of the case was that the judge validated the research that Guide Dogs has done into curb heights, which means that nobody is going to be able to just look at it and go, "Pah, you know, that's a load of nonsense. That's just somebody coming up with something to suit their argument." It has been validated, and it will be something that people can use, and that's a really good thing as well.
So what happens to you now then? Are you now a crusader for all things, or... back to the day job now, is it?
It's pretty much back to normal. We do, there are various things coming up that we have to try and keep an eye on. You know, the council has to go back and do this equality impact assessment. So therefore, they have to consider the guide dogs research. And here in Northern Ireland, they have to consider the road service policies, which actually state that the minimum curb height should be around 120 millimetres, I think it is, which will then take into account, access onto buses for wheelchairs and pushchairs. So they're going to have to take all of that into consideration and consider what they're going to do again, which is going to take some pushing from us and some watching from us to make sure that they do it and that we are consulted. I think it would be quite difficult for them to come up with the same conclusion. It is possible, but you never know. We might be able to stop further. I'm not sure if we'll actually change anything in the centre of Lisbon, but further projects, future projects, will hopefully have a positive impact from this.
But as you say, something you're going to have to keep a watch on
going forward. Yeah. Definitely. And I'm not sure how that's going to play out, but hopefully it'll be a case of just sit back and let them do their job properly this time.
Well, it's a great victory for you, and it certainly will have an impact and reverberations around the country as more of these schemes are brought to the fore, and even for existing schemes, which, you know, are being reviewed as we speak. This could be interesting. This could be a very interesting result for a lot of that. So well done to you, Joanna, and thank you for giving us your time here on The Weekly Connect.
Not a problem. Thank you.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, trying to organise assistance can be a challenge, especially if it's a last-minute trip. Also, often requires a phone call and, in some cases, an awful lot of hope. Well, a new startup in the UK is aiming to make it easier by just using your smartphone. AssistMe is the startup, and it's launched in Coventry. Don Hyams, who is disabled himself, joins me now to tell us more about it. Don, what is your intention with AssistMe?
So, AssistMe is a disability access app that allows a disabled user to request assistance in advance of turning up at the service provider, and the service provider to be aware in real time of the needs of the user prior to them turning up, and then also able to action the assistance that user has requested in real time. They see the user coming towards them a little bit like a reverse of an Uber cab. So when the user gets there, they're ready and waiting with the assistance that the user needs, which in turn means that the user's got the kind of confidence to go out and about and do their kind of daily life with more ease and also without having to plan so far in advance.
Yeah, that's one of the big challenges, isn't it? It's the planning in advance thing that really annoys us as disabled people. Everything in life has to be planned hours and hours and days in advance. Your app attempts to take that portion of it away and put it in the hands of the consumer, the person who wants to travel.
It really, the kind of ways that Sysme can be used and hopefully will be used is almost limitless. Absolutely, the most obvious applications are in transport, so in rail, aviation, parking, fuel, but then also retail, offices, and basically anywhere that you kind of interact with a service provider, we feel that Sysme's probably got a use there. Obviously, in rail particularly, at the moment you have to book up to 24 hours in advance. So Sysme is currently looking to actually work with rail providers to change that, so suddenly users can leave the house, press a button on their phone, request assistance, as well as booking their ticket with their disabled rail card, turn up, and the assistance they need is ready and waiting. And similarly, they'll be able to look at train times, look at whether the lifts are working, all of that kind of integral information also there in the palm of their hand, in the one app, in the one place. That's kind of the idea. And, you know, as we evolve into sort of different areas, then obviously it's about kind of collating that information that's useful to the user and putting it all in one place so that they can easily navigate the world around them in the most straightforward way.
You know, there are apps these days that can let you buy milk at 2 a.m, and there are apps that can, you know, deliver a pizza to your door on a Saturday night. And it just seems crazy to me that we're at a stage where, you know, as disabled people, it has taken to this point to get an app that does this kind of thing. Because, you know, currently when you go out there to get assistance, it is a bit of a faff, isn't it? You know, trying to organise and arrange and contact the right people and then hope it turns up and all of that. You know, it really is quite archaic.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you explain how you currently have to get assistance to people that might not otherwise be aware, they can't believe that you have to plan 24 hours in advance. And obviously, like many disabled people will know, is that that is completely unattainable and you never know your travel plans. So why should you or could you be able to say exactly what train you're going to be on any particular day? Also, obviously, kind of with Sysme, it's a case of taking those problems and those issues that people face, and currently, you know, how they deal with them is a completely haphazard way of tricks that they have. You know, for example, I personally have a certain way that I can ensure that I never get left on a train. So I get one person to hold the door and another person to go and find someone. But, you know, not everyone is able or would like to be doing that when they turn up. So actually, creating a solution that stops all of those methods that people have created for kind of navigating their environment and offering a kind of one sort of bespoke solution that works for all users is kind of the name of the game, really.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Getting assistance shouldn't be a team effort that, you know, is some kind of game that, you know, a whole bunch of people have to gather together on a train to make it happen. It's just ridiculous. You yourself are disabled. Is it from your experience that this comes from, that this need clearly exists, that you feel this has to happen, that the app is important?
The app isn't by any means my creation. It kind of was conceptualized back in 2010 and then kind of hit the app store, I suppose, early 2015. So it's on Android and Apple.
But it's clearly something that you feel personally strongly about, I guess. I mean, I don't want to ever go down the route of thinking that, you know, as disabled people, we all are some homogenous group and we all think the same way. But but on this issue, I think there probably is agreement.
Absolutely. I joined AssistMe because it was an amazing opportunity to work on a solution of a product that could actually revolutionize assistance and access for millions of disabled people. Before that, I was working in TV production. And so kind of obviously my skills working in TV production as a producer were reasonably transferable into communications at AssistMe. And it was a great opportunity to actually work on something that I truly believed in and hopefully could help people with as well.
So this app is out now. It's, as you say, available on iOS and Android. What, in terms of facilities, can it facilitate, I guess, at the moment? What can you do with it?
So very honestly, the app now is available in a variety of locations, but it isn't kind of maybe as useful to everyone in the UK as it will be as time goes on. So at the moment, we've got a number of service providers on there, including, for example, extra motorway services, a few NatWest locations, etc. But as time goes on and in the coming months, they're going to be having trials with Grand Central Railways and other sort of railway companies that are to be announced, as well as working in fuel and other sectors. So kind of keep your eyes peeled in the sort of coming months, weeks or months, really, because it's really kind of taking flight in the near future. If you do happen to live in the Coventry area, we have a real high concentration of users in Coventry. We have about 60 plus service providers, which was a great opportunity for us to kind of see what happens when you build service providers by locality. So actually with Coventry, we wanted to make it as accessible as we could as a city. So we've got all kinds of service providers on board there. We've been working in partnership with the council and Citizens Advice. But then also we've got all sorts of theatres, bars, libraries, you know, you name it, and there's a kind of service provider available. So it'd be great to kind of hear feedback from people in that area too.
Amazing. Well, you know, I wish you all the best with it, because it sounds like a great app and a great thing that we really need. I mean, it just seems so obvious, really. But it's only ever obvious until someone comes up with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And exactly. That's the we hope that the best ideas are in some ways the most obvious and the simplest. And it's a question of now making sure that the technology is as useful and as simple and straightforward to as many people as possible. The app itself is kind of completely accessible. It uses the accessibility features on the Android phones and Apple iPhones that is now so good. So it should be kind of suitable for everyone. And we've kind of tried really hard to make sure that that's the case.
Well, good luck with it, Dom. Great to talk to you. Still to come, we've got our Society of the Week going back to 1865. Yes, we go back to a society that's been helping blind and partially sighted people for quite a while. It is Sight Cymru. That's coming up here on the Weekly Connect. Now, getting into employment is a major hurdle for people with visual impairments. The process of applying and employer attitudes are big factors in blind or partially sighted people not getting an interview, never mind an offer. However, projects from RNIB have been successful in the past few years in securing opportunities for us to show our skills and prove ourselves to employers, not that we should need to. Chris is one such recipient of this kind of support, and I met up with him recently to find out how he benefited from support within one particular scheme in RNIB in Scotland. Okay, so I've just come over to meet Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Stephen. How are you doing? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Nice to meet you. So you're taking part in a new project. In fact, you've been involved in various projects as well with RNIB before, about getting into employment. Tell me, if you don't mind, your story of getting into employment and RNIB's support with you on that.
Well, I first heard about RNIB through word of mouth, really. At the time, I was unemployed on the job centre, but they never mentioned RNIB at all. It wasn't until a friend of mine got some help with it as well. And then I asked Heather if she could help me out as well, try to find something for a bit of employment. And yeah, it just kind of kicked off from there, really.
Okay, so that's Heather you're talking about, Heather Barbara, who's actually just lurking behind me over here. I'm going to talk to Heather in a minute from RNIB, but I want to talk to you, though, about your experiences of this, because there are a lot of people out there who think when they're losing their sight, if they maybe have born with no sight at all, that their chances in employment are very slim. Is that where you stood when it came to employment? Did you think you would have a hope in hell of getting a job?
No, I don't think it's been something that I felt has held me back personally in the past. The job I'm in just now in childcare, it's not like being in front of a computer screen, so I don't think that's any sort of barrier. But I've always felt comfortable within myself in terms of my eyesight. It's not the greatest, but I still think that it doesn't hold me back as a barrier for, you know, the work that I need to do. So I don't think it's that much of a detrimental thing to me personally.
That's interesting because, you know, we speak to so many people who've got different views on that, and some people think that their sight loss holds them back. Others' attitudes as well is a big challenge. You tell someone that you're visually impaired and they have an image of you already that kind of stands in front of your abilities. You've obviously not felt that.
No, certainly not. I've always feel comfortable in my sight, as I say, and the tasks that I need to do in front of me. If there's any issues at all about, you know, what my eyesight might impair me to do any sort of job, I do feel confident myself to raise that with the management or whatever and just take it from there, really.
Do you mind me asking a bit about your sight? Have you always been visually impaired?
Well, I have something called Marfan syndrome. So that's like a hereditary condition that does affect the eyes, affects the bones, affects the heart, so I've got enlarged aorta. I lost the sight of my left eye when I was 3 years old, and I got it's called a glaucoma, so it spread to my right eye as well. But fortunately, the NHS doctors at Gartnavel managed to kind of save the lens. I feel like the lens got taken out in both eyes, but with the help of glasses, it's, you know, I can do daily tasks. Without glasses, it's kind of blurry. It's not really any use. But with the aid of glasses, I don't feel as if, you know, I've missed out on anything, because I can't really remember being able to see out both eyes. So if people ask me, like, what's it like to see out of one eye, well, you know, I'm like, well, I don't know. I can't compare it to looking out of two eyes because I don't remember it. So I think
you'd have a point of reference on that.
No. But I don't. I mean, I can see. You know, I don't really. I kind of try and make, you know, the most out of it, if you like.
In some ways, you're aware you see less, but it's not enough to bother you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think that, oh, he or she can see more than me or whatever. You know, if we see the same thing, then I'm thinking, well, that's obviously, but they must see it as well. So, even though it's not being able to see out both eyes, but I still be able to see all, you know, of what we're looking at. I certainly don't, you know, see less, I feel like, of what maybe anyone else would.
What do you think about the label of visual impairment or sight impaired or whatever it is that someone comes up with this week? What do you think of that label? Do you want that label? Do you consider yourself having that label?
I would consider myself having that label, yes. In terms of other people's perception, I'm not sure. Maybe the glasses that I wear make it less obvious, whereas if I'm wearing contact lenses, it's a lot obvious that, you know, I have some sort of visual impairment. But, you know, being blind in my left eye, obviously that's a kind of obvious way of someone seeing that I've got visual impairment. But no, with glasses, I don't think anyone, you know, generally I need to tell them that I'm blind in my left eye before they actually realise. But no, I mean, having the sight with my glasses as well, I don't think it's as much obvious for other people to see, you know, than I would. But yeah, I would consider myself Visually impaired, definitely.
Do you disclose that when you were going for the job, for example? Did you disclose that you had a visual impairment? Did you tell the employer?
Yeah, I always tell the employer. As I say, I don't try and hide the fact that I have it, but also say that, you know, there'll be some tasks that are maybe I would need additional help for, but in general things, you know, it should be no problem. But again, I don't hide it. I always disclose it with anyone, really.
You know, some might be forgiven for thinking when they're listening to you talking, and you're clearly a very confident guy, and you know you've tried to, I guess, in some ways maybe put your sight loss behind you. It's not the first and foremost thing about you and your life. It's not you as a person. It doesn't define you. Why then did you feel that RNIB needed to be there to support you in your getting into work?
I think RNIB, the sort of thing that I was looking to get out of RNIB most is a kind of shared understanding of what it's like for someone with, you know, a visual impairment to get into work. As I was on the job centre, I didn't feel I got any, you know, help, any additional help. They never mentioned RNIB, sorry, at any point. So I thought that wasn't as much help. I thought working with RNIB in the Work Choice Programme, that could have given me a kind of extra boost and maybe a few more contacts into somewhere that can, you know, help me get, you know, employment. And as it turned out, it only took a few months, and, you know, 2 years later, still employed with the same employer and doing pretty well.
And you're growing in that job?
Yeah, definitely. It's just over 2 years now. They put me through my SVQ, just completed that last month. Yeah, in terms of the employment I'm in just now, I feel I'm very competent and confident in the job that I do. Certainly don't feel the visual impairment has any boundaries to it at all. And certainly my employers haven't indicated that either. So it's just going from strength to strength, really.
Now, at this point, I want to bring in Heather, who's been lurking here, Heather Barbers from RNIB. And Heather, I'm going to wheel my chair over to you a bit, if that's okay.
Yep.
just to say, you know, I want to talk a bit about this upcoming programme that we want to talk about a bit, to tell other people about, mm-hmm. which is a very similar programme to the one Chris was on, with a few exceptions, and you'll talk mm-hmm. us through that. What does this programme do for people like Chris and for people who want to get into employment? Can we start from the beginning on it?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Now, the programme that Chris was with us on finished at the end of March this year. That was called Work Choice. So that's no longer delivered in Scotland. We now have the new programme, which is Work First Scotland, which is supported by the Scottish Government. And we deliver that, our team deliver that, in most parts of Scotland. If somebody's in an area we don't work in, it's just due to contractual reasons, we're funded for certain areas. So if somebody was in a different area, we can put them in touch with the local provider. So, you know, anywhere in Scotland is covered by Work First Scotland. I think the main differences I see for the new programme is the level of in-work support that's available for people. So, you know, quite often people move into a job and sometimes things just don't work out. The support's not there. There's a lot involved when you first start a new job. So we're there to make sure that these issues and things that come up are being addressed and, you know, help people find ways of overcoming it so that they can stay in the job. So, you know, for that reason, it's not just any old job. You know, it needs to be the right job, because if it's going to work out and you're going to be able to stay there and progress, as Chris has done, it needs to be the right job.
What kind of challenges are you talking mm-hmm. about? What are people likely to face in a job starting out?
Yeah. I think that the kind of obvious ones are sometimes the technology that somebody might need. So, you know, if you need to be able to access a computer in your job, you perhaps need software on the computer so that you can use that. So where we can come into that is to help somebody with their application to access to work, which is a job centre scheme aimed to provide the support and financial support as well, so that somebody can have the right equipment that they need in work. For some people, it might be travel support. You know, that could be provided through Access to Work to help with the costs if somebody needs to get taxis to and from their work, if they're not able to do the journey independently. So again, we can help people to get that support into place.
So there's quite a lot in it, as you say. There's a lot of areas that support is needed, and that will come through this. It's Scottish Government funded. It is for Scotland. It's not for England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. There may be different schemes, I guess, going on
Absolutely,
around the country.
Yeah.
And I guess the best advice there would be get in touch with RNIB on the helpline and you know, take it from there and find some of that support. But in Scotland, this is what we're talking about
in
here.
Scotland. I would say, you know, for anybody who's listening who would like to learn more about this programme, or indeed about any of the other support that the, you know, our team can offer, because we do have other things besides Work for Scotland, I would say, you know, to contact the helpline, and they can then direct them on to ourselves, or if they're in another part of the country, the relevant employment advisors for that.
Chris, coming back to you, do you think the support that you got from RNIB helped you and got you closer to a job than perhaps you might have not had the opportunity to get, not necessarily because of your own abilities or confidence, but because of others' attitudes, as I talked about before? Do you think RNIB just got you over the edge a little bit on that one?
Yeah, I think definitely the direction was what was missing from the job centre. Working with RNIB, it kind of closed the gap, or, you know, because before it was in the job centre, it was kind of more, you know, general stuff, things that weren't really suited to what I've done in the past, you know, my own abilities. Whereas with RNIB, it was only a couple of months from starting the Work Choice programme to then actually starting in a place where, you know, I've worked before in that kind of field in childcare. And I felt that was missing, you know, from before. So from that aspect, RNIB and the Work Choice programme definitely kind of nudged me along to the point where just kind of floating about and, you know, kind of no man's land to actually getting to the end point of employment. I think RNIB definitely helped massively in that.
I think that's the key thing, isn't it? I mean, this programme you're talking about, Heather, is very much for people who are in a position to get into work. There are other schemes that can help people who are not quite ready for the workplace,
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our team, our service, we're there for anybody who's looking at employment or employability and anywhere along that kind of route, really. So, you know, we do have provisions for people who aren't quite ready to get to work yet. So, you know, people perhaps need support to get involved with things to build their confidence before they would even be looking at, oh my goodness, I'm going to go and get a job, you know. So, yes, absolutely, we can work with people at both ends and everywhere in between. I think just mentioning with Chris and the support that he's mentioned he'd had from us in the past. You know, when he started his job, and this is a real thing about Chris, you know, he showed very quickly that he was a very valued member of his team. He started in a temporary post, which we were able to help him source and set up, and it was just for a three-month period. And as he came to the end of that period, his employer said they didn't want to lose him, and they took him on as a full-time permanent employee. So, you know, it's. I think it goes to show that something that started off as almost like a paid work trial, you know, it worked out really well for Chris. He did a great job, and 2 years later, you know, he's fully qualified childcare practitioner. So he's a real asset, and, you know, personally very proud of him. So yeah.
And how did that feel?
Oh, superb! At the start, I thought I didn't know what to let Heather or RNIB down, because they were the ones that nudged me along to, you know, they were the ones with the contacts, they were the ones that set it up. You know, we're in conversations with the kind of the government aspect in terms of the funding as well. So I felt I had 3 months to kind of make as good an impression as I could on my employers, and, you know, thankfully it's all worked out.
So, Heather, we've got everybody's appetite waited, if that's the right phrase.
Yeah.
So how do people find out more about this particular programme in Scotland?
Okay, I would say that the best route to access any of our services really is to go to the RNIB helpline. Although I'm Glasgow based and covering generally, well, a lot of the west of Scotland, I have colleagues in Edinburgh and somebody who's working from Aberdeen as well. So rather than give my number, because people might not be in my area, I would say go to the helpline and let them know which area of Scotland that you're in, and they can put you in touch with the right service.
Okay, Heather Barber from RNIB, thank you.
Thank
Chris,
you.
Really good to talk to you, and I wish you all the best.
Pleasure, thank you very much. Cheers.
You're listening to The Weekly Connect. Stick around, I'll give you that phone number again if you want to listen to the show, or you want to tell someone else that they can listen to the show via the mobile phone or landline phone. Details and all that coming up here. But first, to our Society of the Week, and it's established back in 1865. Site Support, as it was called then, became Site Cymru. With its head office in Pontypool, Site Cymru prides itself on being the only entirely Welsh sight loss agency that provides services throughout Wales. And that's why we chose them as our Society of the Week.
My name is Hilary Lester, and I've been involved with Site Cymru really since I was registered blind in 2002, so 15 years ago. Well, I first contacted them when I was actually registered blind in 2002, because although I knew it was coming, it was still a shock to me. And one of the nurses at the Royal Gwent gave me the telephone number for Site Cymru. I got in touch with them and they were absolutely brilliant. They sent a rehab officer out to me to help me with things in the home, and also somebody to do some mobility training with me. So very good. I've always been extremely short-sighted. My mum thought I was clumsy when I was young because I was always falling over and bumping into things. When I went to school, it was picked up in school that I was extremely short-sighted. I then had various problems over the years, including detached retinas. The last three operations I had were just prior to me being registered blind, and I had three operations in the space of 6 months. I had a cataract operation, then I had a detached retina following that, and then I had high optic pressure, which they couldn't get back down, so they had to do another operation to clear that, and that basically, well, it's clobbered the sight that I have got. I've got very little bit of peripheral vision, and that's all. Basically, the fact that somebody was out there and was able to give me the information that I needed on how to cope, certainly in the home, mobility getting out. At that stage, I had enough sight to be able to manage with just the symbol cane. But since then, my sight has deteriorated and I've had more mobility training from the rehabilitation officer using the long cane. Again, that's been through Site Cymru giving me the right pathway to be able to do that.
My name's Nick Williams. I'm a volunteer at Site Cymru. It's about 2 years now I've been here. I'm totally blind. I got no sight at all, really. Really, it all started off with the council. My local council work closely with Site Cymru, and I was going to council meetings and that, and Site Cymru came up and they said, if you're looking for somewhere to volunteer, phone Site Cymru, really, and that's what I've done. And I've spoken to a wonderful woman called Rebecca Harris, who dealt with my case, and I went for an interview, and that's how it all started, really. They just asked me my age, where I lived, and any sight loss I got, and what sort of stuff I'd like to do with them. And at the moment, I'm on the ring around scheme. It's where I phone the elderly, anyone with sight loss, elderly people who cannot make it out. I just give them a courtesy call every week, and we talk about whatever they want to talk about. Oh, it's helped me a lot, because of my sight loss, I had problems mixing with people, because I had a lot of people calling me names whenever I went out in the street. I had no confidence at all, really. But when I joined Site Cymru then, they've given me the help I needed. They've boosted my confidence, and I'm a totally changed person, and it wouldn't have been, well, it wouldn't have been like this if it weren't for Cymru, really. I work just one day a week on a Monday, get to speak to a lot of interesting people and all, and meet new friends. I like to say I recommend if anyone is anyone in the area who are looking for places to volunteer and that, because they're a bit nervous about getting jobs or anything, they could always try and phone Psych Cymru, and I'm sure someone there will be able to advise them where to go or give them some sort of advice.
I feel kind of like an allegiance to them because they were there for me when I needed them, and I want to put back into their society some help because they helped me when I needed it. The chief executive of Psych Cymru, I went to an open day and I was quite keen to do some sort of volunteer work for them. And she basically approached me and said she felt I would be a good trustee for them. So I was enlisted onto the board of trustees, which again gave me a very good insight into it. I was expected to attend trustee meetings, which were generally held quarterly, that covered things like looking at their expenses, how they were spending their money. If anybody applied for a grant to have money from them, we looked at those and decided whether or not the person that had applied for it would qualify. We were also expected to attend any events that they hold. So they do yearly a Wales and West conference. So we were expected to attend that if we could. I mean, obviously some people are working at that stage. I was working, but during the day, so I was able to take time off to attend the events and basically support them as much as you can and really be an ambassador for them. It didn't take up a vast amount of time, but there was quite a lot of reading prior to the quarterly meetings, as obviously we had an agenda and things to go through. Sometimes we had to look at some of their policies and things and make sure that they were up to date and correct. So, yeah, it was an interesting role that I have actually stepped down at the moment because I've now got the guide dog, because Psych Cymru have given me that independence. I am doing much more and I wasn't finding the time to do the trustee role properly.
And that's it for our show. Thanks to everyone for getting involved. Just a reminder of that phone number again. If you want to listen to our show or you want to tell someone that they can listen to the show via the phone, you can do this on the new RNIB info line, the number 0203 4321 488. Standard call rates apply. Mobile rates may vary. Do check with your operator. Once you've dialed the number, hit option 3. That's another way to do it. Of course, we're always on the podcast. And if it's Monday at 1 on RNIB Connect Radio, it's the Weekly Connect. Thanks for listening.